51008, and we'll recognize Mr. Mitchell.
May it please the court. The district court facially invalidated Texas's requirement that abortion doctors hold hospital admitting privileges because it concluded that the law lacked a rational basis and imposed an undue burden on abortion patients. Each of these conclusions is wrong and should be reversed, both for the reasons provided in our brief as well as the reasons provided in the panel's opinion. Because this case is likely to be reviewed by the Supreme Court, we respectfully ask this court to reject the plaintiff's facial challenges for each of the independent reasons described in the state's brief and in the motion panel's opinion. We also urge the court to emphasize the plaintiff's evidentiary shortcomings and the failure to carry their burden of proof, in addition to rejecting the legal theories propounded in their brief. The plaintiffs want this court to permanently invalidate the state's admitting privileges law based on a report from Joseph Potter, which the district court refused to credit or rely upon, and which is based on untenable assumptions that have already been proven false and that the plaintiffs now acknowledge are false.
Is the 20,000 plus point that's made throughout the brief of your opponent only contained in the Potter evidence? The 20,000 women?
Yes.
That's only in the Potter evidence.
That is a number that Potter derived by assuming that every abortion doctor that lacks privileges on the date that the law takes effect will never get them, and that clinics run by those doctors will close permanently and never
reopen. And the district court didn't credit that information.
It did not. It did not rely on that or even mention
it. Well, he didn't rely on it. We don't know. He didn't exclude it either.
That's correct. He did not explicitly reject Potter. He did not endorse, rely upon, mention, or in any way credit Potter's testimony.
Well, but it was in the proposed findings of fact submitted by your opponent.
Yes.
Specifically, and the district court took other parts of that same paragraph from the proposed findings of fact and did not take that proposed.
That's correct.
Should we infer anything from that?
I don't think there should be an inference of a district court fact-finding that would trigger deference. I believe the court should review Potter's testimony and give it the weight that the court thinks it deserves, and that should be no weight because it's based on numerous.
Is this problem with the tension between sort of Potter saying it's going to be 20,000, nobody's going to get admitting privileges, and then the reality that's emerged, which is some doctors have, as acknowledged by your counsel opposite, some have received privileges and so forth. Is that a reason why this really ought to be an as-applied challenge rather than a facial?
It's certainly a reason for why it should not be brought as a pre-enforcement challenge, because as the Seventh Circuit recognized in a Woman's Choice Eastside Clinic against Newman, it is an abuse of discretion to enjoin a statute when the effects of that statute and the reason for those effects are open to debate before the statute has been allowed to take effect. There's no way for the plaintiffs to prove with reliable evidence what the actual effects of this law will be before it has even been allowed to take effect. And we can see that by looking at what they represented to the district court about what they thought would happen and what actually has happened now that the law has been in effect for 2 months. Clinics that Potter said would close forever are now open.
How do we take that into account on this appeal?
Simply by looking at what the plaintiffs have conceded. They've said in footnote 3 and 4 of their brief that specific doctors have managed to obtain privileges, that specific clinics have remained open. They said in their recent 28J letter that was filed in this court that Dr. Lamar Robinson, who runs Abortion Advantage in Dallas, now has attained privileges.
So is it it's appropriate for us to take judicial notice of those facts that were not before the district court based upon concessions made by your opponent?
Certainly. And this is one of many reasons why Potter's testimony is not reliable, why the district court was correct not to rely on it, and why this court should explicitly reject it in its opinion. Because evidence, expert testimony of this sort is not an acceptable way to prove what the effects of the law
will be. Do we have to reject Potter for you to win?
No, not at all.
Okay, why not?
Because the law does not impose an undue burden that would trigger facial invalidation of the statute, even if Potter were somehow correct in his predictions.
Is this because of the fraction that 22 over 88 is a fourth, roughly?
It's for many reasons. That's not sufficient to qualify as a large fraction under Gonzales. But in all events, the precedent of this court has said that when litigants bring facial challenges to abortion statutes, they must meet the Salerno standard and prove that the law will be unconstitutional and impose an undue burden in every single one of its applications. And on top of that, further still, this statute contains a severability clause that says that not only the provisions of the statute must be severed, but even the discrete applications of the statute's requirements to every individual physician, and every discrete circumstance must be severed from each other. So if there are any applications of this requirement that would not impose an undue burden on abortion patients, those applications must be severed and allowed to remain in force.
As you know, Mr. Mitchell, this Court has had occasion to debate the extent of the Salerno privilege several times and generally has rejected the State's position.
There are precedents, however, from this Court that have endorsed the notion that the Salerno standard applies to abortion cases. Very recently, this Court's decision in Voting for America against Steen said that the only situation in which an exception to the Salerno rule would apply is in the First Amendment context. And the Supreme Court said in Gonzales that this is an open question. The Supreme Court said, we're not going to resolve in this case whether the Salerno standard applies to facial challenges in abortion cases or whether this large fraction test should apply. But either way, even under the large fraction test, the plaintiffs still have not proven by a preponderance of the evidence.
I think the best argument for your position is that two other circuits, one of them nearly 20 years ago, have accepted an admitting privileges requirement?
That certainly helps our case, but the real question, I think, for the Court is whether...
What changed in the Supreme Court law that might undercut those?
The undue burden standard, because the Eighth Circuit...
I know, but one of the Fourth was following the undue burden standard.
Yes, but other courts have rejected the admitting privileges requirement. So one reason we're not relying too heavily on decisions from other courts
but
is they can find...
But they're only district courts, right?
Well, the Seventh Circuit's recent decision in Van Hollen...
Well, that's a preliminary injunction.
True. It is distinguishable. But there is certainly language...
Well, I think a key difference in the Wisconsin case is that they were only given 2 days, a weekend in essence, to have the implementation. And in fact, they distinguished the Texas statute as allowing 103 days. It seemed like that was a big part of the Wisconsin case, that it was a preliminary injunction and that there was only 2 days a weekend given to run around and get privileges.
Yes.
Did you not think that was significant?
No, we agree. The Wisconsin case is certainly distinguishable from this one, and we urge this Court to distinguish Van Hollen, especially when four justices have said, or have all but said, that this issue is likely to go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court could very well grant certiorari in Van Hollen. Wisconsin's planning to seek certiorari.
Was the temporary injunction record before the Supreme – was the whole record transcript and all before the Supreme Court on the motion to stay?
I don't know whether they had – I don't know whether they had the entire record that this Court now has, but they easily could have obtained it by going on to PACER, and we cited provisions from that record in our brief. So,
right. Given the time constraints, I just wondered.
I mean, we had it.
We had the transcript and the affidavits. I read all of them on the motions panel.
That's right. And going back to Van Hollen, we believe the Court should both distinguish Van Hollen but also reject it. Because even though Van Hollen is distinguishable for all the reasons Your Honors have suggested, they were applying the preliminary injunction standard. There was this added problem in Wisconsin because Wisconsin gave doctors no time to comply. There is language in the Van Hollen opinion that misrepresents the undue burden standard, and it's important, we believe, that this Court reject that. The Seventh Circuit held, for example, that the undue burden standard places a burden of proof on the State to prove that an admitting privileges requirement is medically necessary. There is no support in Casey to say that the State, rather than the plaintiffs, bear the burden of proof.
And didn't the Seventh Circuit say that the burden was less? It gave a sliding scale depending
yes.
on whether they thought the medical judgment was so good. And they said that there was a lesser showing needed for the other side.
Yeah, that's what the Court said, and that's also wrong. The question under Casey is whether the law has the effect or purpose of imposing a substantial obstacle in the path of an abortion patient. That's not to be measured by whether the Court thinks the burden is justified or medically necessary. The sole question to ask is whether the obstacle imposed is substantial.
I know you think you're preparing for the Supreme Court, but what about the medical abortion provision?
Yes.
I mean, it seems... Neither side seems to have briefed that on the motion for stay to the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems to boil down, according to the plaintiff's concession, to a question of 14 days, whether medical abortion is denied in a substantial fraction of cases to women who might medically require it between the days of 49 RMP and 63 RMP.
Right. That's the issue.
Your brief goes around that in a way by saying, well, the district courts, we're reviewing the district court's injunction, which is inconceivably broad. But they have now conceded that. So what do you say about that 14-day window.
We believe that the entire injunction that the district court carved out, this health exception that he created, was both unnecessary in addition to being overbroad. First, it's unnecessary because the statute itself contains a health exception.
Okay, and I wanted to ask about that. How does what the panel, the motions panel did, differ, if at all, from what the statutory health exception would have done?
In a few ways. As I understand the motion panel's opinion, it would preserve a health exception carve-out for women seeking elective abortions. What the statutory exception says is that it will not apply. The ban on abortion-inducing drugs outside the FDA protocol will not apply when an abortion is necessary to preserve the life or physical health of the mother. Normally, an abortion is not necessary unless the pregnancy itself imposes a danger to the pregnant woman's life or health.
Okay. So the difference is in what type of abortion is being had,
That's
whether
correct.
It's elective versus necessary for the woman's, the abortion itself being necessary, not the method.
Now, there's still ambiguity in the district court's injunction. There's a lot of ambiguity in the injunction.
I'm asking about the motions panel, because the motions panel sought to narrow the injunction and did so with a narrower, if we want to call it, health exception. So it's trying to understand what issue, if at all, you take with what the motion panel did.
Because we don't believe a health exception is necessary in the first place, because we're starting with a statute that already has a statutory health exception.
But the problem, there's several problems with that statutory health exception in my view. One of them is, I'm inclined to say, that the plaintiffs may have the better argument, because the health exception says that abortions after 20 weeks are okay to protect the life or health of the mother, well, where it's focusing on the mother. This, however, is a procedure that's supposed to protect the safety of the abortion itself, if I understand, which is a narrower focus, or maybe the other one is narrower, and this is potentially broader. And the second thing is that it's a finding in regard to another provision of the statute, and it's not clear to me, no matter what concessions the state was making in the district court, that finding pertains, even if read as you want it to be read, pertains across the scope of this new statute.
Judge Jones, I think that is a permissible construction of the statute, but the statute doesn't have to be read that way.
Well, it's a finding. It's not the didactic, portion of the statute.
That's true. It's in the finding section of the statute. And perhaps if this court were conducting de novo review, the construction that you described may be the one that is more sound. But there are two canons of construction in play here. First is the canon of constitutional avoidance. And it's long been held that courts will interpret statutes not only to avoid actual constitutional violations, but even potential constitutional violations.
Well, what does Texas law say about this, the status of a legislative finding, which is a preface to the actual effective parts of the statute?
There's nothing in the Texas Code Construction Act that specifically says that language that appears in a finding section of the statute should be treated differently from language that appears elsewhere. But this, just looking at the plain text, the statute says this act does not apply to abortions that are necessary to avert the death or substantial physical harm to the pregnant woman. I say I'm into my rebuttal time. Oh, I'm sorry. 2 minutes.
Wait, I had a quick question for you on the 30 miles. In a state the size of Texas, 30 miles seems a little bit short. Can you explain the magic of the 30 miles, where that comes from? What is the rationality of the 30 miles?
Rationale is that it should be a local hospital or a hospital that's nearby the clinic where the abortion itself is performed.
Texas, as you know, is a state where people commute from, McKinney down to South Dallas and whatever, which is farther than 30 miles routinely every day. So, 30 miles just seems like a fairly short distance in a state that big. In some states, that would be quite a vast area.
The plaintiff's position is we can't require admitting privileges, period, no matter how wide And so we haven't focused much in this litigation over whether 30 miles.
Well, there's been some focus on the whole Rio Grande Valley and all this sort of thing, and some argument in distinguishing other cases that those cases just required admitting privileges somewhere.
Right.
So I see a little nugget of, well, maybe if you required them somewhere, it wouldn't be as bad as the 30 miles. So I'd like your response.
Because they brought a facial challenge and they're demanding total across-the-board invalidation, their burden is to show that 30-mile radius is unconstitutionally burdensome everywhere through the state. And as long as we can show there's at least one part of the state where the 30-mile requirement does not impose an undue burden, the facial challenge at the very least must
be rejected. And clearly Dallas and Houston,
of course,
not San Antonio.
Any one of these urban areas. Okay. So because the plaintiffs have eschewed an as-applied challenge to the hospital admitting privileges law, they've undertaken what the Supreme Court described in Gonzales as a heavy burden, and they have not met that burden here. I'd like to reserve the time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you. All right. And I've lost my paper. Oh, yes. Ms. Krebs.
Thank you. May it please the Court. The admitting privileges law is not merely an unnecessary yet benign regulation. Both the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists believe that the privileges requirement will jeopardize the health of women seeking abortions in Texas.
The admitting privileges?
Yes, Your Honor. In their amicus brief, they make that statement.
Okay, since you brought that up, I'm confused about something. The American Congress of Obstetricians stated that it has a Texas district of 2,500 members, so that's in Texas, who believe that abortion is an essential health care service. How do you square that statement by presumably 2,500 providers with the evidence you all put on that shows very few doctors prior to House Bill 2 were providing abortion, and that most of them were semi-retired or from other states or so on? How can you square those two?
I think that the point, Your Honor, is that the physicians in Texas, who are members of the American Congress, as well as its national organization, which is much, much larger, in fact, the largest organization of obstetricians and gynecologists in this country, are committed, as they say in their statement of interest, to ensuring that women receive the best health care. And
but
so even though
they're in a position to provide it. So if really these 2,500 people believe it's an essential health care service, presumably a good many of them have admitting privileges because they're obstetricians. And so why doesn't that solve the issue?
The evidence, first of all, Your Honor, not all doctors in any field do all procedures. But the evidence in this case before the district court made clear that there are many reasons why physicians who support women's access to abortion nonetheless do not provide abortions. For example, their contracts with their private practices forbid it. They are on staff at a Catholic hospital that restricts it. They are rightfully afraid of the violence and harassment that has unfortunately been visited on a number of physicians who provide abortions. It's difficult to fault a doctor for not providing abortions when the news has been full of the fact that Dr. Tiller was murdered because he did abortions.
And what did Dr. Gosnell do?
Dr. Gosnell provided substandard care to women and was rightfully prosecuted.
That's a very mild way of describing the situation that, according to Judge Mannion's opinion in the Seventh Circuit, directly led to what the Wisconsin legislature did. But it seems to me we're at a point where we're reviewing a temporary injunction. We're reviewing whether there is an undue burden imposed by this admitting privileges provision, and the district court misplaced the burden of proof on the state to prove that there was a rational basis. In fact, under our law and the Supreme Court law, as I understand it, it's well understood that you bore the burden to prove that there's no rational basis.
Your Honor, I think that is where we respectfully disagree with the court on the burden of proof, and specifically would direct the court to look at the Akron case.
What?
The Akron case.
I thought Gonzales decided, was pretty clear on this.
Your Honor, the Gonzales case has no application here, where the issue before the court is a regulation that is justified on maternal health. Gonzales was looking at a ban on a specific abortion procedure that was justified solely on the grounds of the state's interest in fetal life. And it would prevent no woman from obtaining an abortion. Here, the best guidance for the court comes from Akron, in which the court looked at a regulation that was justified by the state, by the city, excuse me, on health grounds. It's notable that, first, the court did not overturn Akron as applied to maternal health regulations. It carefully limited its overruling of that case to the fact that it had undervalued the state's interest in fetal life. Second, the court in Akron, in a footnote number one, specifically rejected the dissent's suggestion that these regulations should only be subject to rational basis. And then, looking at what the court actually did in Akron, it looked at evidence, it put the burden of proof on the state, and it found that based on the evidence, and specifically that the safety of abortion had evolved in medical practice and a position of ACOG, that the law was invalid. The admitting privileges here is but one step removed from that requirement, in that here we have a district court finding based on substantial evidence in the record that the law is not rationally related to maternal health, that medical practice...
But again, you're changing the rational basis beyond all, you know, conventional understanding of it.
Your Honor, again, I think one issue on which we are...
He didn't fight Akron, did he?
I believe he did, but, Your Honor, I think that we are still in disagreement as to what the standard should be. We do not concede, even though the district court ruled on rational basis, that that is the appropriate test. We believe, given the constitutional status of abortion as a fundamental right, that health regulations are subject to heightened scrutiny.
But the problem you have is you're back to a facial challenge, which whichever way you cut it is a problem for you, and we're back to Texas being a big place. It's got rural areas, it's got urban areas. It doesn't appear that House Bill 2 has been a problem in Dallas or Houston or apparently San Antonio. It may be a problem in the Rio Grande Valley. Why not then bring an as-applied post enactment or post it going into effect challenge and address the Rio Grande Valley or the southern part of Texas or so forth if there really is a problem there?
Your Honor, first I'd like to make clear that you're now moving to the effects prong of the review, and we brought a facial challenge because it was the only way that we could prevent this law from denying women their constitutional right to obtain abortions. The evidence showed that when the law took effect, women would be denied. A pre-enforcement challenge was the only way to try to avoid that, and unfortunately, we were unsuccessful because the law did take effect and women have been denied.
And the doctors have gotten the admitting privileges.
Your Honor, in terms of the evidence that we have, the notifications that we've provided to the court about admitting privileges, I would point out that that evidence only goes to the changes from the evidence that was before the district court, which were that a number of providers did not have admitting privileges. So, for example, if you look at Exhibit 46, which is attached as an appendix to our brief, there is a complete list of the providers that would have to stop providing abortions. The providers that have gotten privileges since then is only a fraction of those.
Is that a different group than the, as I believe the motions panel decided this case based on the transcript in the district court, it said that the reasons why these people couldn't get privileges had little, if anything, to do with the statute. It had to do with other things, such as that they were near retirement age or I can't remember what the other reasons were right now, but
from out of state.
Well, Your Honor, the district court made findings that many of the admitting privileges requirements imposed by the hospitals had nothing to do with the provider's qualifications. Specifically, though, if you look at the Rio Grande Valley, going back to your question about effects, there was evidence in the record as to why it was difficult to have doctors provide abortions in the Rio Grande Valley. The state panel acknowledged that. But the point is that prior to the admitting privileges requirement, there were two doctors providing abortions in two locations at the Rio Grande Valley, in the Rio Grande Valley. And once the privileges requirement took effect, there are none, and women are now forced to travel
to Corpus Christi,
approximately 150 or a 300-mile round trip.
You know how long that takes in Texas at 75 miles an hour?
I understand, Your Honor, but
I mean, this is a peculiarly flat and not congested highway, so
is that distance, though, appropriate in compared to Casey?
I don't think that you can simply draw from Casey the fact that the court there found that travel was an incidental effect and say it is not a substantial obstacle in Texas.
Why not?
Because the undue burden standard, the substantial obstacle standard, is a fact-based inquiry. Casey makes that clear, and even Masaryk makes that clear.
So the fact that they found that the Supreme Court has indicated that similar facts are not an undue burden, we shouldn't take that in consideration?
I think the important thing is to look at the evidence that was before this district court as to whether this would be a substantial obstacle. Now, we are relying primarily on the shortfall of providers, resulting in women being completely unable to get abortions.
See, the bulk of that, it goes back to, it's not caused by House Bill 2. It's caused by, you went in my original question to you about the American Congress of Obstetricians. If that group of doctors actually provided abortion that they believe is an essential health service, you wouldn't have this issue. We wouldn't even be here. The problem is, as you have posited in the evidence you put on, that there was a dearth of providers before House Bill 2. That is not a creature of House Bill 2's making.
Your Honor, I think that in the Casey, the court made clear how to analyze these kinds of restrictions when you are dealing with existing facts on the ground. And looking specifically at the spousal notice requirement, the fact that women, married women in Pennsylvania, were abused and therefore did not wish to notify their husband or had other issues in their marriage that caused them to not want to notify their husbands was a pre-existing circumstance. And yet the court went on to say this law is a substantial obstacle for those women. The same is true here. These circumstances exist and cannot and yet allowed for the provision of abortion, but for now the burdens imposed by House Bill 2. So here I think we can see a very direct result of House Bill 2. Before, there were abortion providers in the Rio Grande Valley, and now there are none. Going back to the travel distance from the Rio Grande Valley,
what will you inform the court if any new clinics open up during the pendency of the appeal here or to the Supreme Court?
Yes, Your Honor, I will. I think, however, that it's important to say that if this court finds these changes in fact that we have felt needed to be brought to the court's attention to be material to the outcome of the case, the proper course would then be to remand, because while we have felt obligated to notify the court of these changing circumstances, we can't, and I don't think it would be.
Did you notify the New York Times?
No, Your Honor.
Did you talk to, I was just wondering, because they had an article on Friday that retailed that one-third of the abortion clinics in Texas were going to close, which is patently false, right?
Well, Your Honor, at the time of the trial, that is what the evidence showed. Since the trial, the facts have changed. But on the flip side,
the New York Times didn't bother to follow up. But
to me, the issue isn't so much the fact-finding, like we need to send it back for more facts because they're different facts. The reality that time did not bear out these estimates, I think, underscores the problem of a facial challenge here. I mean, to me, it is just an illustration of why the facial challenge was a problem versus an as-applied, because you know, predicting the future is hard. Addressing the past is much more straightforward. So I don't think it's a matter of, well, we're going to suddenly find, well, there's two more clinics open than we thought, so that somehow makes a difference, because that's not our role as appellate judges. But wouldn't you concede that the ensuing months have illustrated the problem with your challenge in the first place?
I don't, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, a facial challenge here is completely appropriate, given that the district court found that the first part of the test the state failed to meet. The law has no rational relationship to the state's asserted interest in maternal health. And therefore, on that ground,
the problem there is you had a district judge sort of saying, I'm going to believe these doctors over these doctors. And that isn't the function of a federal district judge in a question of invalidating state legislation. The question is whether the state legislature could have believed these doctors. And if they could, then you have to give the discretion to them. They are the lawmakers, not us.
Your Honor, I don't think that's correct in the context of maternal health regulations on abortion.
Well, then why
justified by maternal health, excuse me.
I mean, even in Gonzales, the Supreme Court, and before that in Casey, the Supreme Court emphasized that the state may regulate the practice of medicine. This is regulating the practice of medicine.
I think there are there's a distinction here, Your Honor. In Gonzales, when the court was referring to the regulation of the practice of medicine, it specifically tied that to regulating medicine in order to promote the state's interest in fetal life, which is not at issue here.
So the women's life isn't significant enough?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that if you look at what the court has done when actually confronted with a regulation justified on maternal health grounds, it has applied heightened scrutiny.
Except it also, the court also approved the requirement that doctors perform abortions as opposed to non-doctors.
That's right, Your
Which
Honor.
Which is a much greater hurdle, it seems to me, than requiring the doctors to have admitting privileges.
Your Honor, I don't think I can compare those two. I think the better comparison is the admitting privileges requirement versus the hospitalization requirement in Akron.
Has there been any post-Casey decision requiring a state to prove that regulations were medically necessary, consistent with accepted medical practice, putting aside Van Hollen, where the state's lawyers conceded that they bore some burden in this regard?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the first part of your question.
I'm asking if there is any post-Casey authority to support your position, your test that you would have us apply.
Well, Casey itself, I think, supports our position. And I think that
it requires that abortion safety regulations be met, that the state must prove that they're medically necessary and reasonably directed and consistent with accepted medical practice?
Yes, Your Honor. And I say that because in Casey, looking at the single regulation that was directed towards maternal health, the record-keeping requirement, the court referred back to Akron and Danforth, the cases from which those standards were pulled.
Can you address
a question about the 22,000? The district court did not find the 22,000, even though the district court was asked to. And the 22,000, the one-third number, seems to be really important to your case. If that was such an important finding, wouldn't you have insisted, and you were winning your case, that the district court put that in the opinion? And the only explanation for that would be the district court didn't credit Dr. Potter on that point.
Your Honor, I think you're aware of the runaway train speed with which this case proceeded from the district court to this court to the Supreme Court. We did not go back and ask the court to make additional findings.
If that's going to be the linchpin of your entire case, that you say 22,000, one-third of all women, wouldn't you say that would be essential to go back and ask the judge, if he just happened to forget it, to add that?
Your Honor, we didn't forget it. Obviously, it's very central to our case. But I think the point for this court is that the district court made the finding that this law would impose a substantial obstacle on women in Texas. If there are facts in the district court record that support that finding, then the proper course is for this court to nonetheless affirm the judgment. If, however, the court feels that the findings are inadequate, the proper course would be to remand.
You're not seeking the injunction to be to be upheld on the parts of the injunction that didn't have to do with the 50 to 63 days, are you, the overbroad nature of the injunction?
No, I have just a few seconds left, and I would like to address that specific question.
Would you explain what if anything, you disagree with the motions panel on the medication abortion?
Yes, Your Honor, and I may have to go a few seconds
go
over
ahead,
time.
Robert.
Thank you. The district court's injunction accurately reflects what the court has said in AYOT, which is that an exception must be made if necessary to preserve a woman's life or health. That must incorporate that if the surgical procedure is less safe, significantly less safe than the medication abortion should be allowed. The difference that I see between what the stay panel injunction said and that language, first, it does not mirror what the Supreme Court has said, which I think is the prudent course to mirror what the Supreme Court has actually said.
But it mirrors the evidence and the findings by the district court.
Your Honor, I don't think that it quite does.
Where, how does it differ?
And it differs in that it does not appear to allow the physician to consider the relative safety of medication versus surgical abortion. Let me give you an example, and then I'll conclude.
And we're only talking about 14 days here.
Between 50 and 63 days, yes, Your Honor.
Right.
For a woman with large uterine fibroids, a medication abortion may be significantly safer. That doesn't mean that a surgical abortion could not be safely performed or that it would still not be a better medical option for a woman than, for example, carrying a pregnancy to term. But under the language of the stay injunction, the doctor would have to find that the surgical abortion was not safe or
endangered the health of the mother.
That's not part of the stay injunction, Your Honor. I think the language is...
Oh, the stay. Excuse me.
Yes. That it's not safe or a reasonable medical option. I think a better way for that would be, for example, to simply say, to change it to say, if it's not significantly safer, to use that language rather than the language that's there, which could foreclose a physician looking at the relative safety.
You know, I sort of hate to see the tail wagging the dog here, and as we read the record, there was minimal evidence in the record about the advisability or the necessity of a medical, a drug-induced abortion for these women. So what is there, as if any, as to the number of women who might actually be affected?
Your Honor, the evidence, as the district court noted, was that it was uncontroverted that there would be some women for whom medication abortion would be significantly safer.
We all know, but the doctor only said something about a few women. We all know that most women do not have these conditions, right? It's a very unusual exception.
And the injunction, the district court's injunction, is limited to those women for
actually,
whom it would be.
It's not clearly limited at all, but that's a separate problem. But aside from the fact that it's not clearly limited to 50 to 63 days, well, let me ask you, why shouldn't you just have an as-applied challenge for the case of women, any women who might present themselves needing an abortion between 50 to 63 days using a medical technique?
Here, Your Honor, I believe that we have done exactly what the court in Gonzales directed plaintiffs seeking a pre-enforcement as-applied challenge to do, which is to present evidence of discrete cases in which a health exception would be necessary. It's not practical nor constitutionally required that each woman with large uterine fibroids, each woman with a stenotic cervix, have to go to court in order to obtain injunctive relief to exercise her constitutional rights, which are the most highly protected, which is a woman who is seeking to preserve her own health by accessing the most safe procedure.
But you're conceding this isn't really, well, it's just preferable. It's not necessary to the woman's health. Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. That the idea of a preferred procedure was why the Supreme Court upheld the partial birth abortion ban in Gonzales. It's a distinct question as to whether a procedure is significantly safer, and the constitutional law on this is very clear that for those women, there must be an exception.
I just wanted to note that the witness from Whole Women's Health, Perigno, said that only 16 patients were in the 46 to 63-day period of the 2,300 who received medical abortions. That was what I was asking you about.
Good. Yes, Your Honor.
To clarify.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Mitchell?
I'd like to begin with the question Judge Haynes asked to my friend in opposition. Do we have any disagreements with the motion panel's modification of the district court's health exception carve-out? And there is one significant concern that we have. The most serious defect in the district court's injunction that the motions panel did not correct is that it opens the door for doctors to use any type of off-label protocol, no matter how dangerous and no matter how untested, including protocols that call for the vaginal administration of misoprostol. I don't think he intended that. I think that was inadvertent, as were all the other overbroad aspects of the injunction. But that was one overbroad aspect that the motions panel did not correct.
Maybe this is a problem with the fact that it was pushed to trial within a week or whatever.
Perhaps. I think the district court was rushed to get the opinion out, as were, I think, every court that has had to handle this issue on appeal, as well as the lawyers who've had to brief it.
But given the fact that there was a grace period in the statute for the admitting privileges, and you all seem to be mostly focused on admitting privileges, he could have taken 2 weeks instead of 1 week.
Perhaps. But also, he was boxed in by the plaintiffs, who waited 3 months after the law was signed to bring the lawsuit. So everyone was working under rush conditions.
Well,
we're not trying to
I was a trial judge, I was always of the view that an emergency of the lawyer's making was not a genuine emergency. But anyway.
Perhaps.
Go ahead.
But we do think it's crucial that this court make clear that if there is to be a health exception carve-out, it needs to be limited to the specific protocol that the plaintiffs relied upon at trial. And it's not the protocol described in the ACOG practice bulletin, which calls for vaginal administration of misoprostol. Several women died after taking misoprostol vaginally, which caused the FDA to issue a public health advisory, and Planned Parenthood has discontinued that protocol
what
in response to that.
What protocol did the woman who was Defense Exhibit 6, I'll call her AJ because I don't know if she wants her name broadcast, but the affidavit that you presented from the woman who used to work for Planned Parenthood and then had a medication abortion, ended up in a bathtub of her own blood, which protocol was that?
I couldn't tell from the affidavit or the declaration whether she took it vaginally or buccally. But again, this is one fact on which Planned Parenthood and the state agree. There aren't many of them in this case, but the vaginal administration of misoprostol should never be used. And also, importantly, in the record of this case, on page 1959, Andrea Ferrigno testified at trial that Whole Women's Health is still prescribing misoprostol for vaginal administration, even though Planned Parenthood has discontinued the practice. So the district court's injunction, if left in place, opens the door for that needlessly risky protocol to continue. Now, there's a more fundamental question. Is a health exception carve-out even necessary in the first place? And we continue to maintain the answer is no. You know, first, for the reason I mentioned earlier to Judge Jones, the statute itself contains a health exception that can be construed to accommodate any constitutional concerns that
this court make that construction if it
yes.
could be done? Shouldn't we at least say that health exception, however, whether it's findings or whatever, that health exception at least applies?
Yes, as long as it's a permissible construction of the state statute. If it would avoid a constitutional problem, this panel is obligated to adopt it. On top of that, the state's officials in this court have endorsed that construction of the statute. So there's an additional reason beyond the canon of constitutional avoidance.
Well, we don't rely on those because those last only as long as particular administrations and particular law enforcers.
Yes, but there are precedents from the Supreme Court saying that the state officials' interpretations still count for something.
We don't have a state attorney general opinion on this, do we?
No, we have the litigating position of the state attorney general. That's correct.
Right.
But even if Judge Jones were to disagree, or this panel were to disagree with what we interpret the health exception to mean, there still is not a role for an injunction issued by a federal district court declaring our law unconstitutional. Because there's a more fundamental problem. Federal courts are not to serve as the nation's ex officio medical board. The Supreme Court emphasized that point in Gonzales. And abortion doctors do not have a constitutional right to second-guess the FDA's judgment regarding the use of a drug, whether that comes with regard to the issue of drug approval or whether it comes to the issue of drug protocol. And we have seen that when individual doctors, rather than the FDA, decide how abortion-administering drugs will be used, women have
the
died.
The FDA doesn't purport to regulate medicine, whereas the state can regulate the practice of medicine. I mean, that's why the FDA can't tell doctors not to use it off-label. But the FDA does bring enforcement actions against drug manufacturers. If the drug manufacturers were to recommend this protocol, that's a criminal violation as well as a potential civil lawsuit. So to me, this is an odd thing to say that the state can't use the FDA protocol when the FDA can go after manufacturers for criminal liability for even daring to mention the 50-day.
Right. It is certainly within the prerogative of the federal or the state government to insist that doctors follow the FDA's judgment, even when an individual doctor disagrees with that judgment and thinks that his patient would benefit
You're
from a drug.
You're getting into deep water there that you don't even need to tread. I mean, on that particular argument, that is not necessary to resolve this medical abortion issue.
It's not necessary. It's one of many arguments for why there's no need for a health exception carve-out here.
Let me just ask you one thing to clarify this a little bit. I thought Gonzales was a little bit ambiguous about the question of where you would do a facial and an as-applied challenge vis-a-vis a health exception. Now, Gonzales itself rejected the argument that the mother's life might require partial birth abortion, correct?
Right.
Said the state had the right to make that decision. But then at the end of the opinion, it refers to, well, there's a health exception. So I take it that that means that whereas in a facial challenge, the courts have to accept the judgment of the legislature that if some applied here, if some particular woman came in who had a fibroid condition and 51 days and goes to the doctor and she's, well, let's say she's had her sonogram and, you know, whatever, but it's now 53 days and her doctor files an affidavit that says, in my view, this procedure will be significantly dangerous unless I do a medication abortion, then you say a federal court could grant an as-applied exception for that person.
Yeah, what Gonzales says is that federal courts could consider.
Am I interpreting that correctly?
As we interpret Gonzales, it says at the very end of the opinion, the courts may consider as-applied challenges in these circumstances. It never said that those would actually be winning arguments or that courts would be under a duty.
Hypothetical at this point.
What they said is, if you want to bring an as-applied challenge, you can bring it and the courts can consider it. It was wrong to bring a facial challenge to knock out the law across the board when all you're complaining about is the lack of a health exception. The plaintiffs in this case have brought an as-applied challenge with respect to the regulations of abortion-inducing drugs. They brought a facial challenge to the admitting privileges requirement. But here they have brought an as-applied challenge.
How can you have a pre-enforcement as-applied challenge?
I've always thought that was somewhat of an oxymoron, but Gonzales says at the end of the opinion that statutes can be challenged pre-enforcement on an as-applied basis. So Gonzales at least envisions the type of case that the plaintiffs are bringing here. But Gonzales doesn't resolve the substantive standard to be applied. And it certainly does not hold that individual abortion doctors can second-guess the medical judgments of the FDA simply by opining that their patient in a particular circumstance will be better off using a drug that the FDA has not approved or using a protocol that the FDA has not approved. The plaintiff's argument proves too much. If accepted, it would imply that abortion doctors would have had a constitutional right to use the Mifeprex regimen before the FDA approved it in September of 2000, simply if they could find an abortion patient who wasn't capable of having a surgical abortion. And that can't be right. That's not consistent with the D.C. Circuit opinion and Abigail Alliance, and it would effectively allow every doctor to become a law unto himself. If the court has no further questions.
That's what we hired them for, isn't it, Mr. Mitchell?
Hired who, the FDA?
No, we hire doctors to use medical judgment in many cases, and off-label uses of drugs are extremely common, like Botox, which was originally prescribed for migraines.
Yes, but that doesn't preclude a state government from insisting that doctors follow the FDA's decisions, which are helpful.
They ban Botox at their risk.
Perhaps. Thank you, judges.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.